Okay. So I'm going to talk about one of the last two topics, station equipment, as you can see here in the list of topics. What I'm going to be talking about are these different topics: receivers, transmitters, amplifiers, transmitter and receiver problems, basic repair and testing. These are all the various topics under station equipment. So we'll start with the definition of what we mean by station equipment. What you see in the upper right picture, there are two separate units, a transmitter and a receiver. This used to be the case years ago when transmitters and receivers were big and they had to be put into separate cases or boxes. What you will have most likely these days is what is shown in the lower right corner, which is called a transceiver. Both the receiver and the transmitter are combined into one unit, and it's called a transceiver. A transceiver, as you can tell, is a combination of the two words, a transmitter and receiver. So we call it a transceiver. And the part that's not shown is the antenna, which gets connected to, so you use a single antenna typically, in most cases, for receiving and transmitting. So that single antenna gets switched. These days, it gets switched automatically between the transmitter and the receiver. So when the antenna is connected to the receiver, you hear signals from others, and when you start transmitting, your antenna automatically usually gets connected to your transmitter so that your signal can be transmitted. This is another piece of station equipment, very common. It's called RF or radio frequency power amplifier. It's a standalone unit. So you can see it has on-off button and has a mode button. One of the two blue buttons in front is mode. And the purpose of the RF power amplifier is to increase the radio frequency output from a low power device, such as a handheld or a low power transceiver. The mode switch, one of the two switches you see on the front, the left one is on-off, but the second one is it switches the amplifier between typically two or three different modes. This has mode switch to switch between SSB, which is single sideband amplitude modulation, or the other mode is a CW, continuous wave, or Morse code, as well as FM or frequency modulation. So, depending on which mode you're using on your transceiver for transmitting and receiving, whether it's SSB or CW or FM, you need to select the proper mode on the RF power amplifier also. And lastly, the blue fins that you see are for heat dissipation because this unit can become quite warm. And so, to keep the electronics inside cool, it needs a heat sink or the blue fins that you see for heat dissipation. Some details of the receiver unit in a transceiver typically. You can buy a standalone receiver these days, but most amateur radio operators get a single unit because generally it's cheaper to get a single transceiver. But here we're going to focus on what you see is actually a transceiver. It's actually a QRP transceiver, low power, but it has both transmitter and receiver. So we'll look at a few important aspects of the receiver. And the three important aspects, and a reminder that anything you see in bold or in italics is going to be a keyword or a phrase in the questions that we look at during the Q&A session. So the three important things to know about the receiver, there's a term sensitivity. So sensitivity refers to the ability to detect a weak signal coming into the antenna. How sensitive your receiver is so that it can detect really, weak signals coming into the antenna. The second important property is called selectivity, and it's the ability to discriminate between multiple signals. A typical example would be that you're listening to another amateur radio operator on a particular frequency in your on your receiver, and another amateur radio operator starts transmitting on a frequency that is very close to your listening frequency. So you will hear the other person, which is what we call the interfering signal from the other person. and you may not be able to see your original, hear your original signal very clearly. If there's another signal on a nearby frequency, adjacent frequency. So then you would adjust the selectivity of your receiver, which is typically done. There are knobs and buttons. You can select different filters, receiver filters, to change the bandwidth of the incoming signals. The idea is to try to get rid or cut off the interfering signal that's on a nearby frequency. How well the receiver can do this, how selective it can be, is what we call the selectivity of the receiver, whether you're able to separate the signal you want to listen to from other nearby interfering signals easily or not. The third thing to know about is a circuit called preamplifier. It's preamplifier because it sits between, typically between the antenna and the receiver. It could be built into the receiver, or it could be a standalone unit outside that you connect between the antenna and the receiver. And its purpose is basically, as you can tell, since it's connected to the antenna, it amplifies really weak signals coming from the antenna, so that they are. And this is a preamplifier is really useful if you have a receiver that doesn't have a great sensitivity itself. So then you can use a preamplifier to increase the signal level of the signals coming from the antenna. A few circuits that you would find inside a transceiver, and these are obviously, there are going to be questions. That's why you have to know and learn about these circuits that are inside the transceiver. So the picture shows a transceiver with the cover removed. Some of the circuits you see with different components on printed circuit boards. Some of those circuits are the three most important ones are described here. We won't identify them in the picture, but there is a circuit in the transceiver that's called a mixer. And the main thing to know is what is the purpose of this mixer circuit? And the answer is that it converts radio signal from one frequency to another. So there will be a little bit more explanation in the coming slides. The next circuit you should know about is called an oscillator. It's a circuit in a transceiver that generates a signal at a specific frequency. Basically, we are looking at the definition, the basic definition of these circuits. And that's the definition you have to learn, because it will be referred to in the questions. The third circuit is called a modulator. And a modulator combines speech or other signals with a radio frequency carrier. So we have a diagram coming up. Hopefully, that will make these definitions a little bit clear to understand. And the last thing is that the modulator is a special type of mixer. So the general definition for a mixer is that it converts radio signals from one frequency to another. But when that mixer is used to combine a speech signal, audio frequency signal, with a radio frequency signal, such as a carrier signal, then we call it a modulator. And that's explained in the next slide here. Under transmitter function, these are the basic circuit blocks inside a transmitter. And they will be part of a transceiver because a transceiver contains a transmitter. This is the basic understanding of how your audio frequency signals are transmitted through your transmitter and through the antenna. So we need to know the basic purpose of these blocks. Each block represents a circuit board or a circuit inside the transceiver. So we'll start with the upper left block called the oscillator. You saw the definition in the previous slide. Oscillator is a circuit that generates or creates a signal at a specified frequency, which is the sine wave you see coming out of the oscillator. Oscillator is what we call an RF oscillator, meaning it generates a signal that we see coming out, which is a radio frequency signal, meaning the frequency is in the radio bands, 7 megahertz or 14 or 28 megahertz radio frequency bands. So oscillator creates a signal in one of the radio frequency bands, one particular frequency. That oscillator signal is fed into the next block circuit, which is a buffer amplifier. And it turns out that most oscillators have a very small signal output. The level of signal coming out of an oscillator is usually very small, sometimes millivolts or just under a volt. And we usually need to amplify this signal further. That's where the buffer amplifier circuit comes in. As you can see, the amplitude of the signal coming out of the buffer amplifier is more than the amplitude of the signal coming in from the oscillator. So buffer is a circuit that amplifies the low-level signal coming from the oscillator. And that signal is still at the same frequency. Buffer only amplifies the signal. It does not change the signal to a different frequency. Now we look at the blocks on the lower, starting from the lower left side. At the extreme left is your microphone. It says AF microphone, which stands for audio frequency microphone. And basically, a microphone is a device that converts your sound signal or your voice into an electrical signal. But the electrical signal coming out of the microphone as a result of you speaking into the microphone, your audio frequency signal, the electrical signal coming out of the microphone is really small, just like the oscillator has few hundreds of millivolt signal out. Microphone also has usually few hundred millivolts, like less than a volt signal coming out, and it needs to be amplified. So it goes through a speech amplifier circuit, which amplifies the microphone signal to a higher level. Then it turns out usually we need additional amplification of the speech amplifier signal. So we use one more amplifier, yet another amplifier, typically referred to as a driver. And we'll see why it's called a driver in a second. But again, driver is another amplifier. It just amplifies your audio signal converted into a electrical signal further to a higher level. And then the signal coming out of the buffer amplifier, which is one particular radio frequency signal amplified by the buffer amplifier, and the signal coming out of the driver, which is an electrical signal representing your audio frequency, your voice. These two electrical signals from the buffer amplifier and the driver amplifier, radio frequency signal and audio frequency signal, they are fed into yet another circuit. That's what we call a modulator. So you see two different signals going into the modulator, a radio frequency signal at one particular frequency, and an audio frequency signal, which is in the audio frequency range between typically, for ham radio transmitters, the audio frequencies are in the range of, let's say 100 hertz to about 3,000 hertz or 3 kilohertz. That range of audio frequencies. So the audio frequency signal is changing in frequency as you speak because your voice contains multiple, your audio signal, your voice contains multiple frequencies and amplitudes. So the driver amplifies all of the frequencies contained in your voice, sound or audio frequencies converted into an electrical signal. These two signals are fed into the modulator, which then combines these two signals and creates yet another signal, which is now what we call the modulated radio frequency, which is a combination of the fixed radio frequency signal and the variable audio frequency signal coming from the driver. They get combined in the modulator, and that combined signal or modulated signal is fed into yet another amplifier, which is called a power amplifier, which could be the one that I showed with the blue fins. That could be this power amplifier. And that power amplifier amplifies the signal further, typically to maybe tens of watts, or if you're using high power, it could be 100 or 200, 500 watts, all the way up to, on certain bands, you're allowed to have 1500 watts. So your power amplifier could be amplifying the signal to a very high level. And that signal then goes to the antenna and it gets radiated or transmitted, into space or into the, depending on the frequency, the signal can travel around the world or can go through the atmosphere and reach space, for satellite communication. If you connect some kind of measuring instrument to the antenna, what kind of signal you will see on a measuring instrument, such as an oscilloscope, is shown as a waveform on the right side of the antenna. That's kind of the visual representation of the signal, the modulated signal that is being transmitted by your antenna. And so we have looked at all of the building blocks. I did not mention power supply block because it's assumed that all of these electrical circuits need electrical power to work. So power supply provides, certain voltage or voltages to these different blocks or these different circuits: oscillator, buffer amplifier, speech amplifier, driver, power amplifier. They all get their power from the power supply. Okay, so next we need to know another kind of circuit which sometimes you may need to use. It's called a transverter, which is a combination of transmitter or transceiver converter. And this is different from a mixer and a modulator circuit. This is a third type of circuit, but although its basic principle is kind of similar in some respects to a mixer or a modulator. But you do need to know what is different about a transverter that makes it different from a mixer or a modulator. So a transverter is a device that, for example, can take the output of a low-powered 28 megahertz SSB. Exciter is here another term for the oscillator or for the transmitter, you can say. So 28 megahertz single sideband transmitter signal, or coming from an oscillator which is sometimes called an exciter, it goes into a transverter, and what comes out of the transverter is the signal at 222 megahertz. So this is the main definition of a transverter. It takes a signal at one frequency, such as 28 megahertz, and changes it to a signal at a different frequency, such as 222 megahertz. And typically, transverters, if it's being used with a transceiver, they work in both directions, meaning it will take incoming signal at 222 megahertz from the antenna and convert it down to 28 megahertz and feed it back into your transceiver. So that's what is mentioned in the last sentence, that the transverter typically works both ways. It converts from one frequency to another in both directions. And usually that's a key difference. Your mixer and your modulator, they work one way. They take incoming signals and change them, coming out of their output. They typically don't work in same circuit, doesn't work in both directions. A modulator or a mixer is kind of one-way circuit. Okay, so some information about VHF and UHF. VHF very high frequency and UHF ultra high frequency bands. So when you're transmitting or listening on these two bands, UHF frequencies or VHF frequencies, most of the time these frequency bands are used with repeaters, and you will typically be using the frequency modulation mode or FM mode for communication on these bands and through the repeaters. But another mode that can be used on VHF and UHF is, or two other modes, is CW or Morse code, continuous wave, also called Morse code, and SSB, single sideband, which is a type of amplitude modulation. They are also popular if, there are conditions or there are situations where you want to reach further distance. You may have, heard, or you might remember in some of the previous lecture slides, we mentioned that FM signal at the VHF and UHF bands doesn't go very far. It gets attenuated by different factors, the curvature of Earth, the line of sight, distance from your antenna, etc., etc. But if you want your signal to go further, then you can use CW and SSB at VHF or UHF frequencies. These signals can go further, so that's why they can be good for sending signal further out, which will become weak, but it can travel more distance. And so you will need a transceiver which will support the use of CW or SSB modes on the VHF or the UHF band. So there can be the handheld transceiver you will get with your Gotha kit does not have CW and SSB mode. It only has FM mode. But you can buy another transceiver for VHF, UHF frequencies that will have the CW and SSB modes also for sending signal further. The reason why handheld transceivers don't have a lot of range, or their signal doesn't travel far as a weak signal, is because they're typically 5 watt or less transmitter power going into the antenna. And just one last note that I mentioned already, that you can use a RF power amplifier with your handheld transceiver, which will increase the 5 watt coming out of your handheld transceiver into a higher power, such as 100 watts or 200 watts, so that you can have more range or your signal can go farther. And remember, a power amplifier has different modes, and so you can transmit FM signal through a power amplifier or SSB, etc., or CW by selecting the proper mode. So any signal in any of any mode can be transmitted through the RF power amplifier to increase the range of your transmitter. Okay, a few troubleshooting tips for common problems. The most common problem you'll have with your transceiver, both when you're transmitting or when you're receiving signals, would be interference. Interference can be caused by a number of reasons. Three of the common problems that cause interference, meaning interference usually means you're hearing another signal in addition to different signals in addition to the one that you're interested in listening to. Or when you're transmitting your transmitted signal being received by someone, they are also receiving some other interfering signal along with your transmitted signal. So interference can happen in both directions when you're receiving or when you're transmitting. The three most common problems or the reasons are that it could be fundamental overload, which has something to do with your transmitted signal. The word fundamental here refers to the main frequency that you're using for transmitting your signal, radio frequency, such as 7 megahertz or 14 megahertz or 28.8 megahertz, where you're transmitting at that frequency within amateur radio band. But if you're outputting your modulator circuit is not set up correctly, or your amplifier circuit is set up to too much of amplification, you can cause in the receivers or any receivers in the vicinity of your transmitter, your strong transmitter signal can cause overload conditions in the receivers, and the receivers will start receiving all kind of interference or interfering signals due to this, high powered signal coming into those receivers. Because that could be because, it could be your neighbor's TV receiver or their FM receiver in the neighborhood, and your transmitter signal is causing those receivers to get overloaded due to the strong signal from your antenna. The other problem could be what is called harmonics, which is multiples of your fundamental or basic base frequency. If you're transmitting at 7 megahertz, your transmitter, if it's not properly tuned or if the filters are not set up correctly, your transmitter could be transmitting in addition to the 7 megahertz, your intended signal frequency. It could be transmitted at twice that frequency, 14 megahertz, or three times or four times that frequency, called third harmonic or fourth harmonic, such as 21 megahertz or 28 megahertz. So those are additional frequencies where your signal is also going out through the antenna. And those harmonics will show up as interfering signals on other people's receivers. Then the third kind is called spurious emissions, which can happen due to various reasons, but we'll look at in the next couple of slides how to mitigate some of these problems that can cause interference. So the main thing is that, if someone in your neighborhood tells you that your transmissions are causing interference or overload in their TV receiver or in their FM receiver, or sometimes if you still have the, the parts, the plain old telephone system, the cord, not cordless, but corded phones. I don't think anybody uses them, but they're still around in some situations. So the cord of a telephone can act as an antenna and pick up signals from a nearby amateur radio transmitter. And those can sound like interfering signals when somebody is having a telephone conversation using a corded phone. Interference can occur to cordless phones also, so that can be another, because they're using wireless frequencies, so that's also possible. Basic thing is that if someone tells you that your transmissions are causing interference in their, a TV or radio or phone, then you should check your own TV, radio, phone to see if you're getting interference in your own house, so that you can pinpoint that your transmitter is indeed the cause of these interfering signals. If you don't see any interfering signals because your transmitters and receivers are tuned up properly, your antenna is using proper filters, so you don't see any interfering signals in your own receiving equipment, that means that, the interference in your neighbor's receivers is coming from some other source. that needs to be investigated. So I already mentioned, corded phones, because of their phone cord acting as an antenna wire, can pick up interfering signals from a nearby transmitter or your transmitter. And so one way to remedy this problem, typically in your own house or maybe in your neighbor's house, is to install a radio frequency filter at the phone. That goes usually in line with the phone cord where it's plugged into the wall, phone jack. You put a radio frequency filter that can be built or can be bought very easily for installing. So that's how you will help your neighbor, get rid of the interference being caused by your transmitter by having a radio frequency filter installed at their phone. You can cause interference to your neighbor's TV and FM receivers. And again, this, if indeed your transmitter is causing the problem, then you can offer to or help them install filters that can be built or bought to block the signal coming from your transmitter that's getting into their TV receiver or into their FM receiver. Typically, these filters will go in the antenna wire of the TV or the FM receiver, and it is usually called band stop filter because it will reject the particular band of frequencies that you're transmitting on. The frequency of your transmitter will get stopped or rejected by this filter if it's installed properly in your neighbor's FM or TV receiver. Some more things to keep in mind when dealing with interference, the more things you can try and use to cure radio frequency interference besides using the filters I mentioned. You make sure all TV coaxial connectors on the TV cables are installed properly. If it says coaxial cable, so I think you've learned what the coaxial cable looks like or what it is, how it is made. There's a center conductor, then there's insulation around it, then there is a shield. The second conductor is like a mesh or a shield around the center conductor. So the shield acts as a barrier for interfering signals, radio frequency interfering. If the shield is not connected to the connector or it's broken after repeated use, the shield loses its contact with the connector, the twist-on connector at the end of the cable. It loses connection with the shield of the cable. That's a very common problem when a coaxial cable is used or connected and disconnected repeatedly. The shield can lose its connection with the connector, with the twist connector. So then the shield will start picking up or start, it will stop blocking the interfering signals, and they'll get into the TV receiver or the FM receiver if a coaxial cable is being used and its connector has come loose, not making contact with the outside braid or shield. You can also add what are called snap-on ferrite chokes. And I think there was a picture in one of the previous lecture slides, what they look like. You can easily find them. I think I was talking about them in my last lecture. So you can look at those slides to see what they look like. You can buy them. They're fairly inexpensive. And you can kind of install them over the coaxial cable, snap on, ferrite chokes, and they will reduce or eliminate the radio frequency interference that is caused by your cables picking up interfering signals. You can also install, that is what I was explaining in the previous slides, low pass and high pass filters at various locations in the antenna cable or within the receiver. And those will eliminate the radio frequency, the interfering radio frequencies, by using low pass or high pass filters. Band reject and band pass filters can also be used. So there are basically, you're looking at four different type of filters. Low pass filter allows a certain frequencies to pass through, low frequencies, and it cuts off higher frequencies. High pass filter is the opposite. It allows higher frequencies to go through and cuts off lower frequencies. A band reject filter stops one particular range of frequencies and allows all other frequencies above and below that band to pass through, but it stops frequencies in a certain range. That's called band reject. And band pass filter is kind of the opposite of band reject. It allows frequencies in a certain band or a certain range to pass through while blocking all other frequencies that are below or above that band or range of frequencies. And one last time, a fundamental overload, which is common problem caused to the any kind of receivers in your neighborhood caused by your high power transmitter signal. That's because a very strong signal is being injected into a receiver. So you can use an appropriate type of filter to eliminate fundamental overload interference. Okay, a few other things that you should know to identify and cure interference to your own or to other people's equipment. So many devices these days, if you look carefully, especially in electronic devices, they will have a sticker, which is, you know, part 15 devices or devices that comply with this part 15 of FCC rules. So this will be typically a sticker somewhere on the back of a device, which will say this device complies with part 15 of FCC rules. Operation is subject to the following two conditions, and this is important. Number one, this device may not cause harmful interference. And number two, this device must accept any interference received, including interference that may cause undesired operation. So how this sticker or that, you know, the device manufacturer is saying that device is complying with part 15 of FCC rules, how this helps you is that if your neighbor comes to you and tells them, you know, and this could be any kind of device, you know, could be like the remote control of a toy, you know, radio remote control that uses a radio frequency, you know, wireless remote control of a toy or a RC airplane, or it could be wireless remote for some appliance or some, you know, like a TV. You know, some TVs come with wireless remotes instead of infrared remotes. So it could be anything, you know, a number of things use radio frequencies. So if a neighbor's device is causing interference to your receiver equipment, so your neighbor is using some kind of device that has a transmitter, you know, it's transmitting radio frequencies, and that transmission is causing interference in your receiver. And if you go talk to your neighbor, and, you know, obviously you have to be polite, but, you know, and ask them to see, you know, which of their device might be causing interference in your equipment. And if you see the device and it says that it's a device that complies with part 15, you can point this thing out, that since their device is causing harmful interference to your equipment, the FCC rule says that your neighbor should stop using that device. You know, that's, if you look carefully, that's what it says here, is that the device complies with part 15. Operation is subject to the following two conditions. This device may not cause harmful interference. But if the device is causing harmful interference to your equipment, then, you know, they cannot, you know, according to this rule, they cannot use it, because otherwise they'll cause interference. Anyway, so these are, you know, subtle things you should know about. And most of the time you don't have to deal with these things, but sometimes you do. So you just need to, you know, work with the people around you in your neighborhood to identify the source of interference and to know, you know, how to fix or cure or deal with these problems. And lastly, you know, I already mentioned the bullet points here, but check your station to ensure that it meets standards of good amateur practice. You're not transmitting spurious signals, you're not transmitting harmonics, you're not causing fundamental overload to other people. Okay, a few more common problems. We are coming to the end of this slide set. Distorted or noisy audio signal. If you are, you know, the other person you're communicating with, they're telling you that your transmitter signal is distorted or the audio contains noise so that they cannot understand what you are saying. You know, they're listening to your signal, but they cannot understand your audio signal or what you're saying, then one problem could be the transmitter might be slightly off the intended frequency of transmission. if it's a HT or a battery powered transceiver or transmitter, then one reason could be that the batteries are running low and they need either replacement or recharging, depending on what type of batteries are being used. Very common problem when batteries are nearing their, you know, depletion level, when they need to be recharged, they will start causing distorted audio. That's a very common sign of battery powered amateur radio equipment, you know, running low on batteries. Or you could be in a bad location where you have metal objects or other, you know, tall buildings, other things that are causing your signal to not get transmitted with the correct signal level. If you're dealing with digital modes, such as, you know, when you connect a computer to a transceiver and you do transmissions or reception of digital modes, such as FT8 or PSK or, you know, other types of digital transmissions, any interfering signals or over-modulation or overload or spurious emission, they can cause, since it's digital data being transmitted, basically, you know, zeros and ones are being transmitted from your computer through your transceiver, through your antenna, the zeros and one transmissions can get changed due to interference. So where it was supposed to be transmitting a zero, it might transmit a one due to the interference, and that's called bit error. Bits, which is a shorter version of the word binary digit, we call it a bit. Binary digit is a zero or a one, you know, logical zero, logic one, like one bit can have a value of zero or a one. And so those zeros and ones will get changed to the opposite value due to the interference signal. That's what we call bit errors. And how frequently this is happening due to the interfering signal is called bit error rate. So just remember, this is in italics, the definition for bit error rate. So just try to remember that any interference causing the bits to get changed to an opposite value, which is what we call an error condition. How frequently that's happening is the bit error rate, at the rate at which the errors are occurring. And so obviously, you know, over-modulation or overload or harmonics or spurious, you know, emissions at many different frequencies, it's called spurious emissions. Those can cause, you know, stronger interference will cause higher bit error rate, meaning causing the data to not get transmitted, the zeros and ones to not get transmitted correctly. And lastly, in the receiver, if you are hearing a high-pitched noise or whine, that could be noise from some nearby electrical system. If you are in an automobile using a mobile transceiver, then as I mentioned in the previous slide set, it could be the alternator in your car. Very common source of high-pitched whine these days, especially for indoor equipment, are the fluorescent lights. They have a choke or a transformer, or sometimes an electrical circuit, you know, that is used typically in LED bulbs these days. There's an electrical circuit inside the LED bulbs, or what we call a choke in fluorescent tubes and lights, that will emit radio frequency. And that can interfere with your receiver signal or with your transmitter signal. So you need to identify those sources of noise. That's a pretty common, because LED and fluorescent lights and LED lights more and more are becoming very common, you know, everywhere, indoors and outdoors. So it's becoming a major source of interference. So you need to learn how to deal with or eliminate this kind of interference. Okay, last two, three slides, some tips for troubleshooting and testing circuits using what we call a multimeter or a digital multimeter, DMM. A multimeter is a device that can measure three different quantities. It can measure voltage. So we call a multimeter has all these three devices built into a single physical unit. When it's measuring voltage, we call it a voltmeter setting or voltmeter mode. When your multimeter is measuring resistance, we set it to ohmmeter, you know, mode to measure ohm, which is the units for resistance. When you want to measure current, which is measured in amperes, you set it to ammeter mode or ampere meter mode so that you can measure current. The two most common measurements are measuring voltage and resistance when you're trying to fix amateur radio equipment or just to measure different voltage and resistance to figure out where you need to install a filter to get rid of some interference. So it's good to know basic, to have, first of all, to have a basic multimeter or digital multimeter. The old days, we used to have what is called an analog multimeter, which is the upper left picture with a pointer that moves across a dial. Those are very, very, you know, like rare these days. We're talking about, you know, what was common 2 decades ago. Last couple of decades, what is the most common device is the digital multimeter, which has a digital readout. As you can see, the yellow and the red multimeters have. So it's, and they're pretty inexpensive. Like the one on the right, you can buy from, common, you know, stores such as Walmart or Kmart or Harbor Freight, etc., or Home Depot, for between $10 and $20. So it's good to have a multimeter, the digital multimeter version, and they're fairly inexpensive. And so, and also learn how to do basic measurements for troubleshooting and fixing and testing your amateur radio equipment. So the two most common things you usually do with the multimeter is to measure voltage. To measure a voltage, you connect the two leads of the multimeter across the component where you're measuring voltage, as shown in the picture on the right. So this is called connection in parallel. You're connecting a meter in parallel with the component, which is the rectangular symbol, which is a symbol for a resistor. You're measuring voltage across the resistor by connecting a multimeter leads, the red and the black lead, across or in parallel with the resistor. When you are measuring voltage, make sure the voltmeter setting on your multimeter is using the correct range to measure the voltage. And then the leads are also rated for the correct voltage measurement. If you're doing normal voltage measurements, such as, you know, up to like 200 and 300 volts, you can use the proper leads that come with the meter. But if you're measuring high voltages, 600 volt, 1000 volt, which can be present in a high powered amateur radio transmitter, can have 1000 volt in it, depending on if it's a 1500 watt transmitter. So for measuring those kind of high voltages, you need special high voltage leads that you can buy separately. And lastly, to measure current, the way current is measured, the current has to flow, the current that you're measuring in a circuit has to flow through the multimeter when the multimeter is set to the ammeter setting to measure the amps or the current. The meter has to be put into the circuit as part of the circuit. So that is done by cutting or temporarily, you know, removing one of the connections in the circuit. You may need to desolder or disconnect some wire, and then connecting the meter leads when it's in the ammeter mode to measure current. The meter leads, the red and the black lead, they are connected in series with the circuit or the wire that you just temporarily disconnected, or you broke. This is what we refer to as breaking the circuit by disconnecting one wire in the circuit and then connecting your leads, which now what we refer to as a series circuit, because the same current that flows from the battery symbol through the resistor symbol has to flow into the meter so that the meter can measure that current. So we say that the meter needs to be connected in series with some part of the circuit that's been temporarily disconnected. Okay, how do you measure resistance? That is obviously done by setting your meter to the ohm meter setting or ohm meter mode to measure ohms. And make sure, this is important, that the circuit in which you are measuring the resistance of a component, that circuit is not powered, meaning it's been disconnected from power, as you see in the middle picture, or you have turned the power switch off, or you have removed the fuse, or you have disconnected the battery, so that this, you know, whatever you do, make sure the components or the circuit you're testing resistance, it's not receiving any power from whatever power source is in the equipment. And that is because if you connect a multimeter set to the resistance measuring mode to a circuit that contains voltage coming from a power supply, then your meter will get damaged. It's very frequent, very common that the meter will get damaged. Usually there's a fuse inside the meter that will get blown. Sometimes it can cause more than damage than just the fuse. Fuse can be replaced, the fuse inside the ohm meter. if it gets blown due to connecting it in the resistance mode to a circuit that has voltage in the circuit. But anyways, the main thing is to just remember that, make sure the circuit that you're testing the resistance is not getting any voltage or power from the power source. One last tip here, if you connect your meter set to measuring resistance to a component in a circuit under test, and you notice that initially the resistance of that component is very low reading, like a few ohms or tens of ohms, and then it keeps changing. It's not a steady measurement. The resistance value that you see on the meter keeps increasing gradually with time. That is an indication that the component where the leads are connected, or that part of the circuit where your leads are connected for resistance measurement, it's actually that part of the circuit contains a large capacitor. Large capacitor means, typically you can see that capacitor as a cylindrical, round object. So this is a tip, which can be useful in troubleshooting circuit to know that there is a capacitor somewhere in the circuit. If you see this clue on your meter that the resistance starts from a low value and keep increasing. But for us, the important thing is that this is the definition of, a measurement, resistance measurement that shows the meter is connected to part of a circuit that contains a capacitor. Basically, this is a question. That's why, you should try to understand, what is this clue? What does this clue mean that the resistance keeps increasing from a low value to a higher value? And the answer is that means the circuit contains a large capacitor. Okay, very last slide, which is a very practical tip that you should learn besides using the measuring instrument as a digital multimeter to troubleshoot basic circuits or your radio equipment. A very useful skill is to learn to do soldering or to solder wires and connectors. This skill is very easy to learn. The equipment you could buy for soldering iron and related equipment is very inexpensive. You can, there are tons of YouTube videos because it's a very useful skill to have in general, dealing with electrical circuits. You can fix cables, you can fix broken connectors, not just ham radio equipment, but also, household equipment. You can solder broken wires and things if you know the basic soldering skill. So a few tips are shown here. Once you learn the correct soldering skill, you should use rosin core solder, which is the wire that you melt with the soldering iron to apply or to connect a component to a printed circuit board or to a wire. Rosin core solder is recommended because the other kind of solder that plumbers use that contains acid, and that is used for soldering copper water pipes typically. Acid core solder will eat through the components of your equipment or circuit board. So make sure you use rosin core solder for repairing ham radio equipment or making your own cables, etc., by attaching connectors to cables. Good solder joints can be determined by their look. So if the joint where the solder has flown, after you heat it with the soldering iron tip, if it's smooth and shiny, the top, picture, the bottom picture, the top view, that is a good solder joint. A dull or grainy surface shown in the middle picture, and it's very easy to see, maybe you need a magnifying lens, but you can see if its appearance is similar to what you see in the middle picture, that is a cold solder joint. And how you fix it is usually you reheat with the soldering iron, or you apply after heating the joint, cold solder joint properly with the soldering iron tip. Just apply a tiny bit more solder, make sure it flows evenly and smoothly, and the joint becomes shiny. The last problem you can have with bad solder joint shown in the bottom picture is that the solder was not applied, enough amount of solder wire was not applied, so it did not flow to the wire or to the joint you're soldering, and it will cause, insufficient solder, which will not cause the wire to be connected to the terminal or where you're soldering it. Again, to fix this kind of problem, we just reheat the solder joint, which is what we sometimes call A solder joint that will become loose right after you have done soldering because enough solder was not applied to it. Just reheat the joint, apply some more solder wire, let it melt and flow evenly, and it will become shiny. In extreme cases, you may need to remove the bad solder joint by using some, solder removing tools such as a suction tool or a wire mesh braid to remove the old solder joint and, create a new solder joint from scratch. Anyways, these tips are very useful. That's why you're required to know this as part of the exam when dealing with or making, your own radio equipment or repairing and troubleshooting your own equipment. So this brings us to the end of this set of slides. I'm going to stop sharing, or if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to answer. And I think I went over 30 minutes. That was the limit Rebecca gave me.